Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
I'm just adding a second thing to my news fix, just like I do.
All right. Oh, you're not allowed to do that. Oh, look, here we are. I'm taking my sweatshirt off, and it's the, oh, look. Hey, everybody, it's Kyle Rizdahl.
Oh, hi, I'm Molly Wood, and we're back with Make Me Smart, our podcast about tech. We're just, we have it together.
Trained.
We are ready to podcast about tech and economy and the and culture.
Oh,
they just
God.
Start the music. I can't even see them.
That's what the talkback button's for, Sam. Give us a little heads up, as in, here comes. Anyway.
Here we go.
Much though Molly and I blather, this podcast really is about all y'all and what you're interested in and what we're interested in and us getting smarter together all the time. And today's episode is one of those because we get lots of emails and texts and tweets and take your pick from listeners saying things like, hey, you guys should do an episode on taxes or GMOs or recycling or, you know, whatever. And we get lots of good ideas. But we are taking on an idea today that came in a recent email from Stephanie Aldritz. And she said, hey, can you explain why the economy has to keep growing? And so we said,
yes.
Oh, we can?
We
said, we're already done?
We love that idea. Yeah. Well, I don't know if we definitely can, but we did say, oh, we love that idea, and we're not alone. Susan Tetterton wrote in, well, that is a really fun name.
Isn't that a good name?
I mean, it sounds so British. It's just delightful. Tetterton, writing in from Worthington, Hampshire, wrote in.
or Brooklyn, but whatever.
Or Brooklyn. She quoted author Ursula Le Guin, of course, as one does, who touched on the subject in one of her essays. And Le Guin wrote, in taking uncontrolled, unlimited, unceasing growth as the only recipe for economic health, we've dismissed the ideas of optimum size and keeping the organism in balance. Which is amazing. The whole essay is amazing. She goes on to talk about, like, you really want a baby to grow, but you don't want it to keep growing. Just saying.
Okay. Well, that's a terrifying thought.
The essay is called Clinging Desperately to a Metaphor. And it gets at this exact topic, which we've brought up on the show, too, which is why are we so obsessed with constant economic growth?
So we have gotten an actual professionally trained economist on the phone to help us out with this one. His name is Josh Bivens. He's a research director at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Josh, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so I'm going to start with my all-time favorite economic quote. You ready?
Yep.
Yes.
Adam Smith, An Inquiry into the Wealth of Nations, consumption is the sole end and purpose of all production. Discuss.
Yes or no?
I'm going to say mostly yes. There's going to be a million caveats, which I assume we're going to be spending the rest of the time talking about. But yeah, I think the sort of the point of having an economy and of people going to do their job every day and trying to earn an income is they want a better life for themselves in the form of better food to eat, better shelter, warm place to stay. So if we're calling that consumption, you know, I think that's, you know, it's roughly true. Like I said, the devil's in details and there's a million caveats, but roughly true.
Right. So does consumption, and was there a point at which it tipped over our idea of consumption to just sort of always mean growth? Does it have to be growth?
So I would say to step back a little bit, I mean, I would say if you take the long view, say the past like 200 years, I think growth has been really important in those 200 years in terms of moving most of the world's population away from outright material deprivation. And I would say even today, you know, we've got hundreds of millions, if not a couple billion people who really do just need more income, more material stuff to be free of hunger and lack of shelter and things like that. So I think growth is really important. I think you're right. in that there's a million questions left unanswered in regards to how important growth is. I think the biggest question about growth is we often measure it in terms of averages. So we talk about average income in the U.S. economy. Every quarter, the Commerce Department comes up with GDP growth, and they tell us how much the economy grew. I mean, there's a million questions that raises. I think probably the most important one is the distribution of that growth. You know, like average income in a country or a state or the globe is not the same thing as typical income. And so I think how that income is distributed is incredibly important in figuring out how translating the economy grew by X percent versus how much did human welfare increase because of that. The number one thing I want to know after that growth figure is how it was distributed across the population.
Right. Because the catch is the thing we hear all the time is that we have to grow to raise everybody's standard of living. But really what's happening, especially in this century and especially in the last couple of decades, is that the growth is unequally distributed. I was about to say inequally, is unequally distributed. And thus, those at the top end are doing much better, thank you very much, because of all the growth. And those on the bottom end are simply not.
Yep, that's exactly right. I think there's a lot of slippage between reporting something like average income and charting how much that grew, and then figuring out how much better off a society we have. I think there's a couple slippages between there. The number one is just the fact that typical is not the same thing as average. You know, you have the old story about nine people in a bar who all earn $50,000 a year, and then LeBron James walks in, and all of a sudden average income is $3 million a year. But the typical income in that bar has not budged. Right. And so that's the real way that distribution affects how we think typical incomes are rising or not.
Right.
So is it, you know, there's this idea that once you introduce a metric, then you totally distort the organism because it's trying to reach the, it's trying to hit the goal, basically. Is the problem that we have become obsessed with growth because our only metrics for measuring success are, in fact, average growth?
I think that's a huge problem. And I would say, so that's a problem in a bunch of different ways, like just to get really concrete, like the thing that gets reported every quarter and which is sort of the coin of the realm when you're talking about growth across economies tends to be gross domestic product, which is kind of the value of all final goods and sales in an economy in a given point in time. But it ignores all sorts of things. And so it ignores if someone, say, moves from full-time to part-time voluntarily because they want to take care of, say, a kid or a sick relative, that is an unambiguous reduction in GDP. Is that an unambiguous reduction in human welfare and people's happiness and fulfillment? Lots of times it won't be. And then you get even weirder things where if I fell on my way over here and broke my arm and had to go to the hospital and got put in a cast, all that would add to GDP. Lots of bills, lots of salaries being paid. I'd have been much happier if I hadn't tripped and no GDP had been created. So I think GDP raises a bunch of problems. And I think you're absolutely right that we have this one number people can put all their attention on. And then once you've got the attention on it, you're just trying to make that one bigger. And as an economist, I'm always begging people, there's no one single number that we can use as a replacement, as a pure replacement. The point is, don't use one single number. Use a whole variety of indicators of social progress to figure out how the society is doing. If you focus on any single one, you're going to get the wrong picture. And yet people just have a real tough time doing that.
All right. So tick them off for me and give me your top like five.
Mm-hmm. Sort of indicators of social progress.
If we're not going to use GDP, right? And next month when GDP comes out and I have to go on the radio and say GDP today was up 3.2%. Well, it won't be 3.2%, but you know what I mean. What should I be saying instead?
Yeah. So I would say one thing that people should look at is something called human development indicators, which Amartya Sen, the Nobelist in economics, sort of was the spearheader, the person who spearheaded the creation of those. They include things like life expectancy, share of the population with a sort of given amount of educational attainment. We want that to, assuming we think education is a good thing, we want that to increase over time. I think share of people with access to good healthcare, which, you know, hopefully shows up as life expectancy or something like that. But you also just want to know if they can go. I would add, I'm not sure if this is in human development indicators or not, but to get at the distribution issue, instead of just looking at average income or average wages, I think you should also look at median income, which is sort of that person exactly in the middle of the income distribution, and then look at sort of the low wage as well. So look at the 20th percentile of those things. Mm-hmm. See if the income distribution is, you know, holding together as it grows on average, or is it sort of flying apart? There's a bunch of other things. Oh, and then obviously in this day and age where everyone should care about climate change, you know, just measuring how much carbon we're spewing into the atmosphere seems like a really important thing to keep track of.
All right. So, sorry, Molly, let me just climb in here and with a very quick follow-up. So with the exception of median income, which even that one I imagine doesn't change or is not worthy of mention on a regular basis, all of these are long-term trend issues, right? Life expectancy, percentage of the population with X degree of education, share with healthcare. You're an economist, so you understand the value of measuring things. What's a good way to measure our growth progress, if that makes any sense?
Mm-hmm. So you mean sort of in a more short-term way?
Well, yeah, like, look, man, I go on the air every doggone day, and once a month.
You're part of the problem.
Yeah, I am part of the problem, right? But look, once a month we get the jobs indicator, right? What's an easily reportable, and I'll tell you why I'm asking, right? I did an interview with the president of the Atlanta Fed about a month ago, and he gave me crap. I can say that on a podcast, right? Crap, did I just get us the E? about how we do the numbers every day. And he said, look, you guys really got to branch out. And I agreed with him. And I said, all right, we'll work on it. And you send me your list. I'm still waiting for him to send me his list. But since I have an actual trained economist on the phone, you know, what are some good, handy, here's a snapshot indicator that we can use in this case to measure growth in a germane and relevant way?
Yeah, it's a tough one. Because the ones you mentioned, you're right. There's a lot of data collection effort that goes into them, and so they are not a daily data series.
Right.
I'd say the jobs number is a pretty good one. I would say, you know, over the past couple of years, we've gotten used to those jobs numbers not changing that much month to month. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go back that far. They changed a lot month to month, and it told us a lot about human happiness. It was going down the drain in 2008 and 2009 when we were losing 700,000 jobs every month for a stretch there. So I think if you ask me, you know one number about the economy over the past year, and how is that, you know,
you need to say
something about whether or not people have gotten happier or not. I think probably something like the share of people with a job. I think that only changes over short time periods because of involuntary reasons. Mm-hmm. Like over the very long run, as more people started going to college, that share of adults with a job nudged down a little bit because we had more students and fewer full-time workers. But when it changes over the course of a year really sharply, it changes because we're in a recession or a boom. And so I think recessions and booms track pretty well to sort of human happiness.
Okay.
Is part of the problem, I want to return to the economic conversation, even though this is all making me want to call those people who wrote the little book of Hygge. I think they're based in Finland. Seriously, there's like a happiness foundation or something. It's their whole job to study things that make people happy. And I love the idea that there's like one thing, if we could just find that thing, like people buy more hot chocolate and that means they're happier. However, returning to economics for a moment, how much of our obsession with growth is also related to scale? Like, I have a friend who's an entrepreneur who often talks about how he just wants to start a small business. He's like, I would love to start a small business that would just be enough. But that is not possible because of competition. Because now the competition in America comes from, you know, Verizon or Google or Facebook. And that if you create a sustaining smallish business that competes with any of them, they buy you. And so I wonder if, you know, and I'm up here in the Valley where obviously a lot of companies have stumbled because they have prioritized growth above all else as the only way to be successful. But I wonder how much of that is driven by the fact that we already have these huge economic institutions, companies, that are completely distorting the playing field.
So, yeah, I think that's a really good question. I would say, just to circle back to what you said at the beginning, there are actually economists who study happiness across countries. They take surveys of households and they ask them, you know, detailed questions about happiness, and they see how that correlates to changes in their life. And unemployment really is like sort of one or two on the list of life events that really moves people's happiness in a given point in time. So I didn't completely make that up.
Right. I knew you didn't. I just was also wondering if there was something secret out there that we haven't discovered yet, like it's gum. It's gone.
No, I think it's the really obvious ones that make us all unhappy. It's like divorce and unemployment and things like you'd expect. On your question about the business, I mean, the dynamic you just talked about sounds entirely right to me. that people feel like if, you know, that it's get big or die in the U.S. economy for businesses that are trying to start. I think that's a pretty profound policy failure. I mean, to me, that says that we've become an economy that has allowed, if not encouraged, firms to go for the monopoly play every time. And monopolies are inefficient and bad, and that should not be the play every business is always trying to go for. And in fact, we should usually not let companies get in that position. But you see it all the time. I mean, you see it in the sort of ride-sharing service wars. I mean, clearly, the only thing that justifies sort of the valuations of a company like Uber is people think they will be a huge monopolist. And I don't think we should ever really let them or any company be a monopolist like that. But I think that's the economy we're in. I think that's where a lot of the pressure is. And so when you've got your friend who has the company and he wants to keep it manageable and small to mid-sized, and he's competing against companies that are like more, I guess you could call it ambitious or ruthless or whatever.
Ginormous.
And they are telling investors out there, give me a ton of money up front and I will monopolize this industry and this sector and I'll drive everyone else out of business. And that becomes, you know, a thing that happens and it becomes sort of the play to make. And I think, like I said, I think that's a profound policy failure. I think that's a failure of antitrust along lots of and other things. And so I think it's a problem with the economy, not sort of maybe it is an inescapable fact of capitalism, but there are lots of facts of capitalism that we try to push back on with policy. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me it should be one of them.
To be clear, just as a quick follow-up, to be clear, he gave up on all of that and went to work for Airbnb, just as a coda. As a bummer coda. Please continue.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
it's hard to change the game by yourself.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So just to riff on a question about, you know, companies in bigness and squeezing, you know, every profitable dime they can in pursuit of growth and profit. To riff on a question from Erica Phillips, newsletter writer extraordinaire. Isn't that eventually self-defeating, right? That Amazon will eventually, in a pursuit to cut costs, squeeze every dime out of the workforce that it possibly can, thus prohibiting and inhibiting their ability to buy the product. And the rest of us will eventually feel the wrath of Amazon, as it were. And isn't it ultimately self-defeating?
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, so I would say, you know, one, as a, you know, whatever, brainwashed economist, we were mostly taught monopolies are bad, that they're inefficient, they don't produce enough stuff, and they charge too high prices for the stuff they do produce. So an economy that just sort of constantly allows and encourages people to go for the monopoly play is not going to be a great economy. Mm-hmm. And then the other point I think is really true as well. We talked before about the rise of inequality we've seen over the past generation in American life. And that's a real problem. We're basically taking a lot of money from low and moderate income households who basically live paycheck to paycheck and spend every penny that comes in the door because they have to. And then lots of money is being redistributed to households that can save a lot because, you know, they're rich and they don't need to spend every penny they get. And over time, that basically is going to be a drag on consumer spending because more and more income is going from people who spend every last penny to people who save some of it. Over time, you know, there were some coping mechanisms. We could deal with that. We transferred money. It slowed consumer spending. But we steadily lowered interest rates to sort of give the economy a bit of a spur. And that's been the logic over the past couple of decades. That let's just lower interest rates some more has sort of run out of steam because we're just about at zero on that strategy. And so I think going forward from now, further increases in inequality really are going to grind down sort of the demand side of the economy. They're really going to slow spending. They're going to put a consistent drag on growth. So I think both just in the inefficiency of monopolies and that transfer of money to the top, which drags on demand growth, I think it is super self-defeating.
So is this a conversation that's happening outside of our emails from listeners and this podcast? I mean, to what extent are people seriously reevaluating the metrics?
At the moment, I think the biggest strand of sort of reevaluation of growth metrics probably comes from kind of the, to paint with a broad brush, kind of the green community. I think one of the clear downsides of GDP is it just measures output, how much was produced. You might want to know about the inputs, like how much in the way of exhaustible natural resources were used up in producing that output. And so I think a lot of people have started to ask, you know, whether or not GDP properly accounts for that. I think some people have jumped right to the conclusion that we need to degrowth and we need to slow growth if we're ever going to be environmentally sustainable. I don't think that's quite right. Like, I think we can really put a wedge between, like, we can still create lots of output, but just use up far fewer exhaustible resources, basically substitute other forms of energy for fossil fuel and do other things. You know, that's not easy. I'm not saying it's just, you know, wave a wand, and yeah. But as a matter of theory, it's possible. And I do think there's still a little bit, more than a little bit, there is room for growth that needs to happen to pull more people away from the edge of, you know, actual material deprivation, even if you are, as I am, super concerned about the climate and environment and things like that. But I think that community is the one that currently is asking the most questions about, are we thinking about growth right in any way? And their objections to just dumb GDP are obviously completely right. It needs to take into account lots of stuff, including the exhaustion of natural resources.
Okay, so with the appropriate caveats for climate change is real and it's going to kill us all, and we need more sustainable energy, and all of those very real things that we all know about, here's my poke in the eye. You know how, and I have no idea how old you are, Josh, but some days I'm like, oh man, I'm getting old. And inevitably somebody says to me, it's better than the alternative, which of course is being dead. So if we're not growing, what are we doing?
So I think it depends what country you live in, among other things. I would say, I think there's room for a country that is as rich in the aggregate as the United States to provide lots of increases in living standards and increases in human happiness, almost purely through redistribution. Like, I think we can be on a much slower growth trajectory, but just cut in a larger share of the population on that little bit of growth, and it'll feel great to them. Like, if you tell typical families, over the past 30 years, the U.S. economy has grown on average 3% per year, lots of them will be like, but that doesn't sound right to me, and it would not been right for them. And so I think there's room for some sort of progressive redistribution to really help, even with minimal levels of growth. I also think there is room, especially in the United States, to start taking some of the benefits of sort of technological change and efficiency in the form of more leisure rather than more stuff. You see across rich countries as sort of productivity growth, that's sort of the amount of GDP you get from a fixed bundle of inputs. As that's risen across a bunch of countries, most other countries have seen their average hours worked go down pretty sharply over the past 30 or 40 years. I think the latest time I looked at Germany, the average hours worked for a worker over there was less than 1,500 hours per year. In the United States, it was more like 1,800, and they were almost the same in the 1970s. And so I think telling people, you know, to get really utopian about it, like the 4-day work week, it's not a growth policy per se, but I think it's a human happiness policy. And I think we are a rich enough country that we've got enough floating around in the economy to give everyone a good life, even at today's level of total income. It just needs to be distributed in a more equitable way. So I think if you're not growing, what's the point? I mean, I think the point of everything is better security and better living conditions for the most number of people. I think we still need growth to play some role in that, but boy, we better not ignore the other stuff like distribution and environmental issues and more leisure. I think those are other margins we should be focusing on in rich countries even more than growth. And even in non-rich countries, we need to keep those, you know, at the same level of importance as the growth numbers.
I am totally taking tomorrow off. That's all I'm saying. That's all I'm saying.
Same.
Josh Bivens, he's the research director at the Economic Policy Institute. Josh, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Take care.
Maybe we should take like the rest of the pod off. What do you think? Just run some tone.
I mean, I'm already about to. No. I mean, really, if you think about intrinsic motivation, that you could just give people goals that are unrelated to what they've traditionally thought, they could be like, I could definitely become a leisure achiever. I could work really hard at that.
This is really fun. This is a whole different topic, but I would have a tough time with that. I don't do well with leisure.
I was actually just telling my delightful producer, Stephanie Hughes, who was saying I'm totally speaking out of turn, but she's trying to plan a vacation. And she was like, I'm not that good at relaxing. And I said, oh, you need to go. You need to go to like Club Med, because all of the stuff that is annoying about day-to-day life, like figuring out what to eat and like, you know, just, I don't know, paying for stuff and remembering your credit card away. All that stuff is taken care of. And then you can achieve the hell out of your relaxing, because there are so many activities.
Oh, man.
So if you're like a type A plus about having fun, you can be busy all day, every day, just like activities.
All right.
I am crushing, relaxing right now.
If you are a leisure achiever, send us a voice memo. Also, what you think about growth and economic doom. You know, there's that too.
Yes.
Also, by the by, your predictions for the year 2020. What do you think is going to happen next year? And also, why do you think so? We're doing predictions episodes like the next couple of weeks, I think. Anyway, send us a voice memo. Send it to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Also, we have on our Twitter feed somewhere, and also I think on our Marketplace website, we've got a little how to send us a voice memo explainer somehow, right? We have a video or something?
I know. Yeah, I'm looking right now at makemesmart.org, but we do have an explainer.
Yeah.
I think it's not quite yet on the show page, but we'll tweet it out because we'll tell you how to send us a voice memo. And we will be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
Strong communication skills are critical for success in business and in life. Hi, I'm Matt Abrahams, and I host Stanford Graduate School of Business's Think Fast, Talk Smart, the podcast. Each week, I sit down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you with your communication skills, from conflict management to mastering small talk to tackling communication anxiety. Join us and start to develop and hone your communication skills. Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
Oh, fine. Now. Now, he says, stand by for music.
Smooth. Welcome back. It is time for the news fix. We were not at all surprised by the music. Dedicated listeners will know that last week we replaced the news fix with an important dispatch about my skunky dogs and also that this story got us the E. But since this is professional journalism and I have mostly defeated the situation by working like a demon, a la leisure achievement, we're back to the news.
I cannot tell you, just as a subscriber to Mollywood's Instagram, I cannot tell you the machinations this woman has been through. It is simply stunning what these two dogs did.
I will say, if there was ever a problem that needed to be solved by nonstop moving things and picking things up and carrying them around and just never, ever, ever sitting down or relaxing, that I am the woman for that job, apparently. But now I'm tired.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to go first because mine's a quickie and it's going to get us to whatever you want to talk about. But here's what I want to say. So we're recording this on Tuesday. Today, the House announced the impeachment counts against the President of the United States. Also, they announced a deal on the USMCA, the new NAFTA. And there's a piece in Bloomberg that says, don't look now, but things are getting brighter for Trump. And here's why that matters. As the president goes into a reelection year with things economically looking up, like he's got a trade deal, like the jobs numbers are really good, like GDP is not as soft as everybody thought it would be, I think things look very good for Donald Trump in this coming election.
I think this is exactly, interestingly, the kind of metrics conversation that we just had. Because
yes.
What we will find out is whether indeed the economy and the health of the economy is the only metric by which Americans ever elect their president.
Well, but it's the sales pitch, right? Because now the president can go out for the next, 11 months, 12 months. And say, best economy in history. Stock market's up. Look at your 401k. Everything's great.
Yeah.
Right? And people are going to go, okay.
I mean, that's what I mean.
Click Donald Trump.
And so I think now we find out, is that the metric by which this president will be judged?
I don't think we find out now. I think we find out in 15 years.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, and also, as this piece points out, we're still a year away, and a year is a really long time.
Yeah, but you know what? People are more locked in this election than they usually are. But I think on sheer economic metrics, I think people are locked in by like July-ish of presidential election years. Because the indicators lag, you know, I mean, there's a whole like information flow effect. So I think like 6 months, plus or minus. That's where I am.
Yep. I think we will see.
Yes.
Hey, so other question.
Yes.
This is sort of like explain-a-thon-y, but I have a question about the jobs numbers.
Yeah.
Do the jobs numbers count? Is it just literal number of jobs? So like if I have three jobs.
Yeah.
Because I have two side hustles and an anchor gig, as we have discussed so many times on this program.
Right.
Does that count as three jobs in the American economy?
No. Because you're counting, you're counting people. You're not counting jobs.
You are?
Yeah.
For sure?
For sure. Okay. Yeah.
All right.
Both of those surveys, right? The household survey.
I thought I had a loophole.
No. No loophole. It's not how many jobs do you have. It's are you employed? That's the question that's asked.
So then do we also have numbers, presumably, on the number of people who have more than one job? We have those, right?
I'm sure we do. And with some quick duck going, I could figure it out. But yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Understood.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thanks.
There we go. You bet.
I have two things.
Okay. You know, I'm not, you've had a rough week and so I'm just going to let you have it.
Thanks, man.
Anytime.
And also I want to thank again, even though I thanked her on Twitter, the person who tweeted after that episode and said, get an ozone generator.
Oh yeah.
Which is like this magical piece of technology that's, I get it. Don't email me and say that it's totally dangerous and toxic because
I don't care.
I super don't care. Do not care. I'm going to guess it's healthier than Febreze. Like, we cleared out the house when we ran this thing. But it generates, like, pure activated oxygen. And they use it in, like, hurricane and mold remediation and all of that stuff. And it is the only thing that made the house livable. So thank you,
there you go,
Liz, on Twitter.
So are you staying or are you going to move?
I mean, we're probably still going to have to move because the whole backyard is infested with skin. I mean, we're not really.
So is your landlord, like, pissed or what?
Separate story.
Oh, all right.
I haven't even told him.
he couldn't tell by the fact that you moved all your furniture and everything out to the porch and to the front yard.
He's not
so
local.
It can air out. Oh.
He's not local.
Okay. All right.
I mean, the neighbors all know, that's for sure.
Anyway, we digress.
Hey, so this next story is relevant to my interest for a lot of reasons. One, because I am obsessed with local news, as so many of us are, and what has happened to local news. Because when we look at, for example, our political and business environment, you can trace like so many things. When we end up with corrupt politicians at a national level, it's usually because we didn't have local news to hold people accountable at a local level. And as we know, local journalism has been totally decimated, and we're in this like weird situation now, related to Bloomberg even, where these big, huge private companies, where like Jeff Bezos owns the Amazon Post and Laureen Powell Jobs owns the Atlantic.
The Washington Post, not the Amazon Post.
The Washington Post. What did I say?
You said the Amazon Post.
Please don't tell me I said.
You did.
I did. Oh, yeah, God, I'm so embarrassed.
That's right.
I'm so sorry.
I called,
that's how, by the way, paging George Lakoff.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I called it when I was hosting the morning show. When I was hosting the morning show, I called it the Microsoft Morning Report one morning. But anyway.
Oh, God, really?
Yeah, I did.
Okay,
yeah.
So that was an accident.
Yeah.
It was a disturbing inception Freudian slip.
Yes.
Anyway, all these private outlets own these journalism organizations. And as we saw with Bloomberg recently, it's super problematic in some cases. But I am very happy about the one where the Google News Initiative has just funded a huge local news project in Oakland.
There you go. Good.
Yep. And it's like, I get it. I get that these are complicated issues, and this organization has said Google will have nothing to do with creating the news. But if it's when it comes to funding local news, which I believe to be critical to the foundation of our democracy, I think that is, I'm just going with it. Good news. It's good news.
Totally.
Yep.
All right. So that's one.
Yep. The other one, nah, never mind. It's too local, ironically.
Okay. All righty.
I'm letting
then.
That one go.
In that case, let's
move on. I'm letting it go. I went with the ozone generator instead.
Yeah.
The end.
Fair enough.
All right. But before we get to your calls, which we are about to, quickly, we are going to talk one more time about our end of the year fundraiser.
Yes.
And by one more time, I mean one more time today. We're going to talk about it again next week.
Too, next
it's not the end of the year. It is going on right now. Like every public media organization worth our salt, we have a bunch of brand new thank you gifts.
We do. And I'm
you
holding
can see them all
I'm
at marketplace.org.
I'm holding four of them.
Are you?
Actually.
Me too.
I have socks.
Oh,
what do you
four?
Have?
Four.
Yeah.
I have socks and I have the blankie.
Oh, there's a blanket? Mm-hmm. How come you got a blanket? I didn't get a blanket. All I got were these two lousy pair of socks. I mean, they're great socks. Don't get me wrong. But
you've seen that before. Right. I believe that Kai Ryssdal would refer to this blanket as fleecy.
Well, so would everybody
else.
I'm holding
it up to the camera. What?
It's
the
not like it's a weird thing I say, fleecy. Everybody says fleecy. It's a fleecy blanket. It's a fleecy.
No.
What?
I don't think they do.
Voice memo. Make me smart at marketplace.org. Hook me up. Come on.
Please.
Tell me you say fleecy. What does your blanket say? I'm totally going to Stephanie Patterson, by the way, and getting myself a damn blanket. That's it. I'm cussing twice in one podcast.
I know. Look at you.
I know. We're going blue. I'm playing blue here.
Listen. All right. You're stepping on my line
here.
Sorry. Because this is a real, I mean, this blanket
Working
is so
blue.
Punnily
Working
named
blue.
That you really need to take it in. It is the Marketplace Job Security
Blanket. Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Job security blanket. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
It's so cute. And it's like perfectly lightweight. So you could use it at, you know, in the basement, for example, if you worked down in the basement.
of a stinky apartment.
It is yours for just $10 per month.
Yes. Yes. That's
and I
so
did
fun.
Get the classic. I think I only have one pair of the socks, the classic
ones,
I think, the Let's Do the Number socks.
Ones? Oh, yeah. Those are old. So we got new ones. We got new ones. So here's one. So these are, by the way, worn. We got the worn guy and we got the not worn guy because I had to take some pictures with these yesterday. I joked with Stephanie Patterson that we should auction off the worn socks. And she was like, no, Kai, we're not doing that. Anyway, on the first ones, I'm telling you, there are people out there. Look, people gave $75,000 to watch me drink a pumpkin spice latte.
It was worth
it. I believe there's a market for my socks. That's all I'm saying. So the sock market is not the economy. I'm totally sober, too, by the way.
Come on!
The sock market is not the economy. That's pretty good, right? They're gray with up arrows for the stock market. And then the other one says, we're in the money on one side and stormy weather on the other. So there we go. And I'm going to get me a damn blanket.
I put my Let's Do the Number sock on my hand. And now
we're doing a little sock puppet. All right. So let's run through the numbers here first, right?
You can
get both pair of these socks for $60 or $5 a month. Marketplace.org/donate. I'm sure Stephanie Patterson's tearing her hair out because we haven't given that URL yet.
She's like, say it.
Marketplace.org/donate. That's $5 a month for both pair of socks. And the job security blanket is how much? $10 a month?
$10 a month.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And you can get the blanket or all three pairs of socks
for
$10 a month.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
Wow.
$10 a month, right, guys. I'm just saying, for the price of Hulu, you have job security and sockies galore.
And you help us out. And there's also stickers and all kinds of stuff. And you can get that for any amount.
And or.
So, you know, help us out. Marketplace.org/donate is what you got to do.
Yes.
Because we need you.
Let everyone know that you are a Marketplace investor. And I am just going to throw down now and say that nobody in public media has better puns.
That's true. You got to hand it to Stephanie Patterson and the gang. That's all I'm saying.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
All right.
Shall we hear from you now?
Yes, a couple anyway.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
And thus we will.
Let's see here. When we aired the Explainathon a few weeks back, you heard a question from Mark in Florida who asked us to explain fair tax. Mark is a big fan of this idea. Kai Ryssdal, not so much. We got, I would argue, a not surprising number of comments on fair tax. This is a hot topic. So just to refresh, Kai had argued that if we replace the tax code with a single sales tax, that poor people would end up paying a higher percentage of their income than rich people. I think I may have argued that. Anyway, Mark wrote back to say we decided it might be kind of regressive. But Mark wrote back to say that the fair tax accounts for this by having a monthly prebate up to the poverty line, calculated to make sure everyone has their basic needs met. And he also wrote that, quote, the rich would actually end up paying more in taxes than the poor because they buy a lot more stuff, like bigger houses and cars and whatnot.
So, fair enough.
Prebate.
Prebate, right? But we also got some voice memos from people saying, I don't think it's still such a great idea. One of them from Washington State named Sean Champagne, which you have to pause before you say that because Sean Champagne, it's a little tricky. Anyway, points out that the tax system there in Washington State is pretty close to the fair tax. Income and capital gains taxes are unconstitutional in the state of Washington, it turns out, and basically it's not working out. Huge ongoing battle on how to fix it. Also had a comment from Lisa Carley. She is an auditor. Look out. Here is her take.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Lisa from Connecticut. I'm an auditor, which means I'm skeptical and get paid to do it all the time. And in response on the fair tax, I am very skeptical about it being a great equalizer for people and income, and really for two reasons. One, if it's not going to tax businesses, then what's to stop the rich from creating a simple LLC to buy all of their consumer goods through that instead of buying them personally and therefore avoiding the tax? Great loophole. Secondly, and I think more importantly, is that if stocks and bonds and other investments aren't going to be taxed under a fair tax, that seems to be the biggest differentiator between the rich and the poor, is the ability to invest and, you know, have access to the stock market. Therefore, as long as those aren't taxed, I don't think that we really have a fair tax.
Yeah, tough to argue with that, right? I mean, that makes some sense.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for that. And, yes, of course, as we mentioned, we got a lot more comments on that than we have time for. Now we're going to hear the answer to the Make Me Smart question right now. The Make Me Smart question follows up, actually, this answer on last week's discussion.
Oh, yeah. Whoops.
I know. I love it. It's an arc on classroom sizes. The question, of course, what's something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Here is listener Karen Fagan.
Hi, Kai and Molly. This is Karen calling from Tacoma Park, Maryland. I was inspired to call in because of recent discussions on the pod about what works in education and what doesn't work. I'm working on my PhD in a college of education right now. Something I thought I knew was that people across the country disagreed about the best way to educate children, and that's why we see pretty different policies. I actually think that's still correct, but what I was wrong about is the extent of the disagreement. What I have learned is that overall, we also don't agree on the purpose of education. So we not only disagree on the route to take, we aren't even necessarily heading to the same endpoint. Is the goal of education to give students job skills so that they can go on to earn personal, private benefits? Or is it to help students develop into civically minded and civically engaged adults who contribute social and societal benefits? And yes, I can hear you guys saying, why not both? I know it's a false dichotomy.
Yes.
But I think that until we reach somewhat more agreement about the goal of education, discussions about how to get there will inevitably suffer. But rather than leaving off in the dark place, I'll say that this isn't an insuperable problem, and it's sure to generate a lot more discussion that will hopefully make us all smarter. Anyway, thanks. Love the show.
Karen. That was a good one. That was a good one.
That was a good one. Also, insuperable is a good word.
Yep.
But that is such a great way to break down that those two points of disagreement, which I had not necessarily thought of in that way.
Yeah, for sure.
Because you guys are so smart.
Totally. We did a bunch of these points in a show that we did last January called Think Before You Major. It was all about, you know, what you go into school to study and what you get out of it, really. We're going to re-air it actually over the holiday break, right? Sam, yes? Nod for me.
Yeah.
Yes, we are going to. So it'll be coming up in the feed because we're taking, like, what, 3 weeks off? Or should I not tell anybody?
Well, off is a little strong.
That's true.
There will be some new content in there. But yes, yes, we're re-airing some of our favorite episodes from the year gone by, like you do around this time of year. But not next week. That is it for this week. Don't forget that Make Me Smart is more than just this podcast. We also have, of course, the newsletter, marketplace.org/newsletters, and daily explainers on your Amazon Post smart speaker. Just kidding. I'm sorry. Now I can't stop.
You?
On your Amazon Echo smart speakers. And our newsletter comes out every Friday. I'm just going to stop talking now.
You got to give them the subscribe link, right? Marketplace.org/newsletters. Erica Phillips will hunt you down. Oh, did you? All right.
I just did it early.
All right.
I jumped ahead.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right.
We're tired. This is why we need some weeks off.
It's a long pod today, kids.
Woo. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Hanging in there. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Thank you to our video producer, Ben Heathcote, and to Christian Buckler for recording video in D.C. And thanks to Erica Phillips, who writes our newsletter, as we just mentioned, at marketplace.org/newsletters. And she also writes our smart speaker explainers.
We're going to run out of music. The program was engineered today by Ben Tolliday. The theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez, the executive director of On Demand. Turns out she is still employed here, by the way, because she sent us a Slack which said, I listened to the end last week, people. Thank you. Her name is Tarn Yeves, senior vice president and general manager, who I don't know, actually, is whether she's still employed, is Deborah Clark. Look, if you don't taunt them, they won't respond to you. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, I guess so.
But we'll see. And we'll see if I'm still employed here. So we'll take it from there.
Dark place.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.